Good morning, everyone, on this rainy Wednesday. It is my pleasure to welcome you all to our Developmental Disabilities Grand Rounds. For those of you who have attended previously, you're now used to filling out the evaluation forms. So this is a general reminder for everyone that everyone is please asked to fill out a general evaluation form of this morning's conference. And for those of you who are earning or wish to earn continuing education credits, you must fill out this form and leave it at the back of the room. But everyone, please fill out the general evaluation form. Thank you very much. And it is my pleasure to introduce this morning Mary Louise Hemeter. Mary Louise received her bachelor's at Auburn University and then came to an extremely prestigious program to earn her master's and her PhD here at Vanderbilt University in the Department of Special Education. From Vanderbilt, she went on to the Department of Special Education at the University of Kentucky, where she was assistant professor, and then on to the University of Illinois, where she was associate professor before we were fortunate enough to recruit her back to Vanderbilt. In reading through Mary Louise's vita, it's just fascinating because you have been so productive and done so many interesting things focusing on early childhood social and emotional development, particularly with children who are experiencing bumps along the way in terms of their behavior, social emotional development, and children with or without developmental disabilities. So I am just going to turn the podium over to you. Mary Louise's talk this morning is The Teaching Pyramid Model for Promoting Social-Emotional Development and Addressing Challenging Behavior in Preschool Children. Welcome, Mary Louise. Thank you.
All right. I think this is kind of early to give a talk, but I think it is even earlier for people to willingly come and listen to a talk. So I appreciate y'all being here. I have way more material than I could probably present in the time that I have, but I want to just encourage you to ask questions as we go. That probably makes sense rather than holding them till the end. I want to start off by telling you a little bit about what I plan to do this morning. I'm going to start off talking about the model that we've developed that Elizabeth just introduced and kind of orient you to that model, what it looks like in preschool classrooms. And then I'm going to talk about a series of studies that we're doing related to this model and really focus pretty much on how these practices are implemented in preschool classrooms and how we train teachers to implement these practices. Now, one of the things you're going to notice when you look at this list of things I'm going to talk about is that I'm not going to talk about the impact of this model on children's behavior because we're in the middle of a study and we don't have those data yet. But I'm going to talk about how we're doing that and kind of our early thoughts about what's happening there. The work I'm going to be talking about today is funded by an IES grant, and I'm also going to be talking about Kathleen Artman, who's sitting up here in the front, who's a doc student who works with me. I'm going to talk a little bit about her dissertation, not to steal her thunder, but to kind of talk about some baseline data, and I actually want to acknowledge that LSI has provided some funding for her to do that study. So as I was thinking about how to get into this talk, I was thinking about, okay, who's going to be here? And I knew there were going to be people here who I was going to be preaching to the choir, who work with me, who work on these issues every day. But I was also certain that there would be people here who hadn't done a lot of work in preschool classrooms. And so what I thought I would do would be to orient you to what challenging behavior looks like in early childhood classrooms, okay? And so the model that I'm going to be talking about today is really a model for implementing practices in a classroom to address challenging behaviors. And so I want to orient you to kind of what those problem behaviors look like when we go out to classrooms. So I'm going to show you four video clips here, and then I'm going to talk about all of them at the end. But this first clip is in a preschool classroom, and these are young 3- and 4-year-olds, so they're at the beginning of the preschool year. And this is a large group activity. You're going to see part of the large group activity, and then you're going to see the attempt to transition the children to the next activity. And I want you just to attend to the kinds of behaviors that you see the kids engaging in.
Okay. My group, let's go, please. My group, please. Celia, Joseph. Ah, baby, taste one. Wait, hold on.
All right, it doesn't get much better than that. So it kind of goes on like this for a minute. All right, so this video clip is of a teacher attempting to do early math activity with a group of preschool kids. And these children, you'll notice, well, you'll probably notice, are older preschoolers. This is later in the school year, so they're a bit older.
Can you come up here and help me count how many sides a trapezoid has?
Five trapezoids.
This one also doesn't get much better, so I'll skip to this one. Now, in this one, you're not going to see the child who's engaging in challenging behavior, but I think you'll hear, well, I know you'll hear her.
Me. Your turn.
Me.
Max and Cindy.
You hit me.
It says here, I had a turn being child of the day.
Me, I had a
turn. You had a turn.
People.
Christian.
No, he's not.
Sierra. Gabby had a turn.
No, I'm not.
Gabby, look. You had a turn being child.
No, I'm not.
Who else had a turn?
Me.
I did.
Emma.
Baby.
Benji.
Dustin.
Dusty. But you know what, Gabby? Maybe you can dress the bears today. You know what?
No. No, I'm not. No,
wait.
Okay. All right, and one more, and here you're going to be watching the little boy in the red t-shirt.
Look, I bring you a ladder. Wow, it's like a trap.
No,
it's not a trap. It's called a ladder.
Okay, I feel like you're okay. Always not a
ladder. No, it's not a trap.
Oh, I need one.
No, they are.
Okay, so I showed you that range of clips because what I wanted really to do was to think about the kind of range of challenging behaviors we see in preschool classrooms. So if you look at those first few clips that I showed, it's really hard to tell whether the children's behavior is more challenging or the adult's behavior is more challenging, right? And so when we look at those first two clips, our initial reaction is what needs to be changed about the context, about the activity, about how the activity is scheduled, about how the activity is structured, about how the teacher's leading the activity or managing the activity. As we look at the second two video clips, we're really focused on individual children's behavior and behavior that looks like it's the result of kids not having social skills that they need, more appropriate social way or more appropriate ways to interact socially, but also children whose behavior is persistent even when there's good kind of management procedures going on in the classroom. And so as we were thinking about a model for use in preschool classrooms, what we were thinking about was the fact that you had all of those behaviors happening in classrooms. And so it wasn't enough to say, we need to teach these kids social skills, because we could teach some of those kids social skills in those first few videos, and we're still going to have problem behavior because of the way the classroom's structured, the way the environment's structured. It's also not enough to say, well, let's just go in and get the routines and the transitions and the schedules and the activities better structured, and then we won't have problem behavior, because we know we're still going to have some of those kids who are children whose behavior is persistent, that's going to persist in spite of that. And so what we were interested in was, what's a model we can give to teachers, we can train teachers to use, that will look at the environment, that will look at the routines, the way the teachers interact with the children, that will address the social emotional needs of children through instruction. But also, we needed a model that had in place a process for addressing those children whose behavior persisted in spite of all of that. And so that's what the teaching pyramid model does. And so you can kind of ignore the yellow part, because that's really about the supports that we need to have in place in settings to support teachers. But the blue levels of the pyramid are really about those first few things. So they're about how teachers interact with children, how teachers support children, how classroom routines and activities are structured. It's about transitions. It's about having activities that are engaging to children. The green part of the pyramid is really about what strategies we use to teach social skills, promote emotional competencies, and then the top of the pyramid, you'll hear me talk about top of the pyramid children, are children who need an approach or who need more individualized intensive interventions. Now, the way that this model differs from what other people are doing in this area is that if you think about researchers who are looking at social emotional curriculum, those almost always fall in this green level of the pyramid. So they're looking at systematic ways to teach social skills and promote emotional competencies. But they're not looking at the other levels of the pyramid. Or we have really good practices for addressing needs of kids at the top of the pyramid, but those practices are really hard to implement if you have a classroom that's chaotic, like that first video we saw. And so what we've tried to do is develop a framework that would allow teachers to implement practices along all of those levels. And so what we think of as the pyramid is not that it is a curriculum, it's not a curriculum, but it's a framework of practices that have evidence to support their use. So using positive descriptive feedback for children's behavior, using systematic instructional procedures to teach social skills, using function-based interventions for children whose behavior is persistent, all of those are integrated into the pyramid model. So while the model as a whole doesn't yet have data to support it, the practices within the model do have data to support them. So what I'm going to talk about related to this model, I want to talk about three studies that we're doing as a way of kind of talking about what these practices look like in classrooms and how we can get teachers to use them and how we measure the implementation of these practices in classrooms. So one of the first things we did was to develop a fidelity measure, a measure that we could use, or a tool that we could use to measure the extent to which the teaching pyramid practices were in place in preschool classrooms. And we wanted this tool for a couple of reasons. One, we wanted to be able to define what does a classroom look like that's implementing these practices with fidelity. We wanted to be able to distinguish between classrooms that were implementing it with a high level of fidelity and classrooms that weren't. But we also wanted a tool that we could use in our professional development we were doing with teachers. And so I think we feel strongly that part of professional development for teachers is providing teachers with feedback about their own behaviors related to the skills that you're teaching them. And so we wanted a tool that would help us do that. So we developed the Teaching Pyramid Observation Tool, which is shorthand referred to as the teapot. And that's why you often hear people around my office talking about the teapot. We developed it, and then we did some initial work on looking at some of the psychometric properties of it. But before I talk about those, I want to talk about just real quickly how the teapot's structured so that you can understand the data that I'm going to present in a minute. So the teapot is designed to be used during observations in preschool classrooms that should be conducted for about a minimum of 2 hours. During which time we want to be sure that our observers see both child-directed activities, so free play, center time activities, as well as seeing activities that are more teacher-directed. So you saw a couple of teacher-directed activities in that one. We collect this, we score the teapot using both our observations as well as interviews. So there are some items like how teachers communicate with families about children's problem behavior that obviously we're not going to observe during a two-hour observation. And so we have interview questions that get at those practices. There's three kinds of items on the teapot, and I'm going to talk about each of them in a little bit of detail here. So the first set of items are just basic environmental arrangement items, and these are things that you could score almost without children being in the classroom. So they're basic things about how the environment's arranged, how easy it is for children to move around the classroom without interrupting other kids. You know, we know that one problem in preschool classrooms is when you have wide open spaces that says to children, run. So we like to not see that. We like to see classroom rules posted. We like for there to be enough centers for children, enough play materials for children, and that they're prepared. And so these are basic things that we consider to be prevention strategies. So these are things that we do that will help prevent problem behavior, but it also helps with the management of the classroom, which then frees up the teachers to be interacting more with the children. And so these are all scored basically as yes or no, they're in place. Then we have a whole set of items that are more about what teachers are doing. And these are the practices that we score either based on our observations or our interviews. And they're based on, they're scored on a Likert scale, which I'm going to show you in just a minute. But what you can see from the practices that are listed up here right now are these are practices that are primarily related to the environment and how teachers are teaching social skills. So one of the times we know transitions are most likely to happen in problem behavior is most likely to happen in preschool classrooms is during transitions. And so there's an item about how transitions are structured. We know that children are more likely to engage in problem behavior when they're not engaged in an activity, right, that's meaningful to them. And so we have an item that looks at how teachers promote engagement, have items about how they teach social skills. So these items are, we initially designed the tool to score these items. So for those of you guys who are early childhood people, there's a set of environmental rating scales that people use that score teacher practices on a Likert scale like this. Well, one of the things, and I don't want to get into too much detail, but this will be important to understanding the data in a minute, is that the way that this was designed to be scored, each of these indicators are scored as yes or no being in whether or not you observe them. And then you use the number of indicators under each anchor to determine whether the teacher gets a score of 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5. But when you do it that way, you get teachers who look really different getting the same score. And again, this is a little bit of a technical thing here, but I think is important to understanding why we did what we did. So the way that it works, in order to get a 3, you would have to get everything under a 1 and a 3, right? So you can imagine a teacher who gets who is doing all the items under a 1, and she's doing 2 of the items under a 3, and she's doing an item under a 5. Well, she's still only going to get a 2 because she didn't get any of those she didn't get all the items under a 3. You could also have a teacher who does everything under 1 and one thing under 3 and nothing else, and she's going to get a 2. And those teachers are going to look really different. And so what we've moved to doing now is not using those scores of 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, but looking at the percent of the indicators that teachers are implementing. Okay, and so when I present some data in a minute, what I'll be talking about is the number, the percent of indicators, and what I'm talking about at that point is each of these indicators under the scores. So across the items that are scored like this, there are 108 possible indicators. So when I talk about percentages, it'll be out of that 108. These are the items that are based primarily on that are scored based primarily on teacher report, and they use a similar format to these items. It's just that the way we get the information is through interviewing the teacher versus observations. Then we have another important thing, just one more thing to say about this, is in some of these kinds of rating scales, the lower end of the continuum represents practices that you don't want to see, so represents poor implementation. The lower end of our scale really represents kind of base level practice. So it's not that people are doing things wrong or not doing things right or whatever. They're just doing kind of base level practice. And as you move up to the indicators under a five, what you get to are an indication that the teacher's doing things more systematically, more intentionally, and more in a more individualized way. So those fives are often hard for teachers to achieve. So that's important because then the third section of the tool really has what we call red flag items. And these are things that are less developmentally appropriate practices. So these are things that we don't want to see. So it's the kind of other end of the continuum. And I've just put some of them on here as some examples. So the majority of the day is spent in teacher-directed activities. Transitions are more often chaotic than not. Children are not engaged. Teachers are giving directions to all children in the same way. When they give directions, they're telling children don't stop, no, as opposed to telling them what to do. And teachers aren't encouraging interactions between children. So there's 16 of these, and these are just a few of the examples of some of them. So the first thing we did was, the first study that we did was really looking at the psychometric integrity of the teapot. And we were interested in a couple of things. We were interested, first of all, in ensuring that this tool could be used reliably, that multiple observers observing at the same time would come up with a similar score. We were really interested in making sure that there was stability in scores across time. So we wanted to know that if we did this multiple times, teachers would get a similar score unless they had been trained, okay? But in the absence of any training, it was really important for us to see stability in scores across time. And then we were interested in the concurrent validity of the teapot with a more global measure of classroom quality. And so the way that we looked at these were we did a G study, a generalizability study, where we did, these folks up here like are probably having nightmares about this study. We observed 50 classrooms, primarily Head Start, not all exclusively, but almost all of them were Head Start classrooms. And we observed each classroom three times with two observers in each classroom. And then between the second teapot observation and the third teapot observation, we did an observation using another tool, the CLASS, which is the Classroom Assessment Scoring System, which is a more global measure of classroom quality. Let me tell you just a little bit about the CLASS, and then I'll get back to telling you what we found. So the CLASS is... I was talking a minute ago about environmental rating scales that are commonly used in research in early childhood. And one of the limitations of the scales that are used is that they focus primarily on the environment, and there's not a lot of specific information on teacher-child interactions or what teachers are doing to support children's learning. And so the CLASS is a tool that was developed to kind of address those constructs that weren't addressed well in other tools. And so the CLASS measures three dimensions: emotional support, classroom organization, and instructional support. And you can see that the whole tool has 10 items. Okay, so the bulleted points under each of the dimensions are the 10 items. And so it's a very global measure. Those items are measured on a scale from 1 to 7. And you do multiple cycles and you average the score across cycles and then you average those scores. So it's a very kind of gross measure of quality. But we felt like it was what was being used to define quality in early childhood classrooms, and so that's why we chose to use it as our measure of concurrent validity. And so the findings were, good news about the findings of this study were that, in fact, most of the variance that we found was about classrooms, which is what you would want, right? You would expect classrooms to differ. We found almost no variance accounted for by difference in raters or occasion. And so our raters were able to administer this with a high level of reliability, and the scores across time were consistent and stable. And what was particularly encouraging about those findings was it wasn't just that the rank ordering of scores were stable across time, but the actual scores were stable across time. And what that was important to us, because our next step is then to say, can we change teacher practice related to this? And so we needed to know that those scores would be stable over time in the absence of the intervention. When we looked at the correlations with the teapot in the class, we got significant, I would say meaningful correlations, but with all of the domains of the, with all three dimensions of the class. This will be interesting when we talk about what changes we did or didn't get when we trained teachers to do this. All right, I want to talk just briefly about our two intervention studies, and then I'm going to present data from all three of these studies together. So we've done two, we're in the middle of the two studies I'm getting ready to talk about, and so half the people on our research team right now are out in random places all over this region of the state collecting data this morning. So this is a study, and I want to just make the point for those of you guys who know the IES goal structures that this was a Goal 2 grant that we had to support this, and we got funded to do this under the old Goal 2 guidelines, which meant that you had to have some measures of the impact on children, which I think is less of a requirement in the new Goal 2 structure. And so our study is a relatively small study, beginning to look at the potential efficacy of the model. This is a study that we're doing in public school classrooms, and that's going to be meaningful when we talk about the results. So these are public school, preschool classrooms, some inclusive classrooms, some classrooms for children at risk. It's a randomized group design. Teachers have been assigned to intervention and control conditions. And we did half the teachers last year, and I'm going to talk about the data from those teachers. We're doing the other half of the teachers right now. The intervention teachers receive a pretty comprehensive training package, which is 3 days of really intensive training, which I'll again talk about in a minute, implementation guides and materials, and then weekly observations by coaches who are sitting here in the front row, who do weekly observations in the classroom, meet with the teachers to give them feedback, and then send them an additional set of feedback via email sometime during the week. Control teachers get training at the end of the study. And then these are the things that we're measuring as part of this study. So we're measuring fidelity using the teapot, as I talked about. We were also interested in whether that would have any impact on overall classroom climate, teacher-child interactions, and we chose to use the class for that measure. The child measures are a little bit harder to think about and talk about, and I'm a little bit concerned about them, and I'll again talk about why more later. But so we're doing three measures of child behavior. One is a classroom-wide measure of behavior. So we were interested in not just can we change the behavior of those kids whose behavior is persistent, but can we change that kind of ambient level of problem behavior that we see in classrooms, you know, like we saw in those first two video clips. And so the way that we're measuring that is we are doing observations where during every interval we code, did a problem behavior happen or not? Not who did it, not how many problem behaviors happened, but just did a problem behavior happen. That's our kind of classroom-wide measure of problem behavior. Then we have target children who were observing their individual problem behavior, and we identified those children using the child behavior checklist, and we're collecting observational data on their behavior incidences. And unlike the classroom-wide one, we are collecting data on whether their behavior incidences are high intensity or low intensity. And of course, we've defined that rather systematically. And then as a global measure of change in behavior and social skills, we're using the social skills intervention system, which is really a teacher report of problem behavior and social skills. Kathleen, in her dissertation, is doing a very similar study, although the professional development looks different. So her studies all is being done only in Head Start classrooms, so that's the difference. And she, again, is using a randomized group design, but with random assignment at the center level, so all the teachers in a center are getting the same, are in the same condition, and that was really at the request of the program that we're working with. And that, well, I can talk about that in a minute. That becomes important in understanding these data. her teachers, the intervention is a little less intense, so the teachers are getting one day of training, the same materials and guides that we were talking about, and then they're getting their feedback all via email. And so the idea here was, are there more efficient ways of giving teachers feedback that will result in changes in teachers' behavior? And one way to do that that we had found in another study we did was that email feedback could be effective for changing teacher behavior. And so we're doing, the idea of the study originally was that teachers would videotape themselves, upload those to a website, we would watch them give the teachers feedback, but there was all sorts of technology issues. So for this study, we're actually going out and doing the videotapes and then using those to get feedback. And one of the interesting things about that, or one of the cool things about that, is that that when Kathleen does the feedback to the teachers, she embeds video clips. So the teachers actually see video, she embeds clips from the videos that she's been watching. And her measures, she's doing everything, the same measures as we're doing in the other study, although she's not doing the target child measures. So, excuse me, thinking about all of those, what I want to do is take a few minutes here to talk about what are the status of these practices in preschool programs. And I want to do this, and I think this is important because when we talk about this model, a lot of times researchers will say, but those are just good developmentally appropriate practices. Those are just things teachers do anyway. Or if we're talking to teachers, we get this, I already do all those things. And we don't see that happening in preschool classrooms. And so, as you can witness in the videotape that you just saw. And so one of the things we wanted to do was kind of say, what's the baseline level of implementation of these practices in preschool classrooms? And so all of these data represent, well, the TPOT study, the big study that we did on the psychometrics of the TPOT, all of those, of course, were untrained teachers. In the other two studies, these are the time one data for these teachers. So this is before they've been trained. So I think there's some pretty interesting things here. One is how consistent our findings are on what baseline practices look like across these three studies. So the studies on either, on the first study and the third study are mostly Head Start classrooms. That's important in a minute. And then the middle study, the efficacy study, is the one that we're doing in public school classrooms. So on the environmental arrangement items, so those are those first set of items, what you see is that teachers are doing most of those. Teachers in Head Start classrooms seem to be doing those with a little more fidelity or doing more of them than teachers in the public school classroom, but we've been having discussions about over the last week about why that might be. And some of the environmental arrangement items are things that people can make you do, you know. So the Head Start director can say everybody's going to have posted expectations and they're going to look like this, and they can make sure that that happens. And we think that's happening in preschool classrooms, in Head Start classrooms. In the public school classrooms, every classroom is in a different school. So there's no administrator saying you have to do this or you have to do that. And so I think that's why we might be seeing a little bit lower scores on that. When you look at the red flags, again, you see some consistency across the number of red flags. And generally, on average, the number of red flags teachers have are pretty low, which is good. We want it to be zero. But the range is pretty staggering. And so a classroom that has all 11 red flags is a chaotic classroom, okay? And so we see, obviously, we don't see a large percentage having a large number of red flags, but we do see a fair number of classrooms with really high numbers of red flags. So the last row are really the percentage of indicators of each of those little indicators that I was talking about. And I think there's a couple of interesting things about this. One is how consistent it is across all three of our samples of classrooms. And so that idea that teachers are already doing these practices, what it looks like is teachers are already doing about 40% of these practices, but that means there's 60% that they're not doing. And so I was looking at, does the 60% represent whole items, sets of practices, or is it indicators within practices that teachers are missing? And so I looked a little bit more closely at that. And generally speaking, if you think about these items that are a 1, 3, 5, teachers aren't getting fives very often. And those practices really represent that notion of individualization or differentiation, and we just don't see teachers doing that. But in the big teapot study, I was looking at these data last night, there were some items, like teaching social skills and emotional competencies, where almost half the teachers didn't get any of those indicators. So during the observation, we didn't see any attempts to teach social skills or promote any kind of emotional competency during the observation. So I think what teachers aren't doing is the higher ends of almost all the behaviors, of almost all the items, but then there are a fair number there are some items where teachers just aren't doing any of it. The other thing that I think is important about these data are the range of scores that we see. So one thing is, if you're only doing 14% of these practices, I'm not sure what you're doing, what teachers are doing. So the low numbers are concerning. But also we believe that, and we're still working on this, that teachers need to be doing, we've set criterion at 80%, and we're not seeing any teachers at that level of implementation when we haven't trained them. Are there questions about that before I move on? All right, so I pulled out a couple of things. So I thought it would be interesting to just kind of understand a little more about what's happening in these classrooms. And so I pulled out from the environmental arrangement items, the ones that teachers most often didn't get. And in the two sets of Head Start classrooms, primarily Head Start classrooms, the one that we saw missing the most often was that materials and centers weren't prepared for children. And when you think about problem behavior, so children are getting to an activity and they're having to sit there and wait for the teacher to get ready for the activity, that's a kind of prime time for problem behavior to happen, okay? And the one that was most often not credited in the public school study was that classroom rules weren't posted. And again, I think that we saw that more often in the Head Start classrooms because it was something that they were required to do. When I looked at the red flags, so this is really interesting. We just finished, we're in the middle, where's Kelly, of analyzing some data from a national survey that we did of teachers. And one of the things we asked teachers to do was to indicate what problem behaviors happen most often in their classroom. And so the one that was rated the highest was children not following directions. Okay, that was what teachers reported happening the most often. So this is a different sample of teachers, I understand that. But in two of the three studies, and what we see pretty consistently across this work, the red flag that teachers most often get flagged for is giving directions to all children in the same way. And so if you think about what that means, so we're saying, okay, to 18, 3 and 4 year olds, we say, everybody, all these kids are playing in all these centers around the room, and the teacher says, everybody needs to put up their toys, get their coat, and come to line up. Well, I'm pretty sure that of 18, 3 and 4 year olds, some children aren't going to follow that direction. They're going to need more individualized directions. They're going to need help walking through the steps. They're not going to hear you. And so I think that notion that teachers are giving directions to all kids in the same way helps us understand maybe why kids aren't following directions. The other thing that we see pretty commonly across all of our studies is no evidence of any conversations around emotions in classrooms. And so it doesn't take a lot to get credit for this, but we don't even hear teachers saying things like, I am so proud of you for finishing your work, or you must be so proud of yourself, or I'm so excited we get to go to the fire station today. We just don't hear conversations about emotions much in classrooms. And so that's the other red flag that we see pretty often. So I want to talk a little bit about how we can get teachers to implement these practices. And this is important to us for two reasons. One is, you know, if you're doing a study on, is small group instruction more effective than one-on-one instruction at getting kids to learn some specific skill? We as researchers can go in and implement that intervention, see if it's effective. If it is, determine which one's most effective. And then we can train teachers to do it, okay? And there's some reason to think that's a good thing to do, that we don't train teachers to do something until we know whether it's effective. Well, this isn't a model that we can go in and do, you know? So we can't go in and like take over a teacher's classroom and restructure it and run all the activities to see if it's effective. We have to have the teachers able to implement the model in order to understand what the effects of the model are. So we had to figure out how to train teachers to do this. It's also the case that all of us who work on this project, or many of us who work on this project, are interested in effective professional development strategies. So both of those kind of have driven our questions around the professional development piece. So I want to talk just quickly about what our professional development looks like. So our professional development is very much based on what little research we have about what helps people change their practice. So we do this really high quality group training with small groups of teachers, four or five at a time. We do a lot of talking to them, but we also do a lot of talking about what's going to be hard about implementing this in your classroom. How can we help you? What materials are you going to need? What are going to be barriers? How can we help you address those barriers? So we're doing that during the training. We're giving them all the materials they need to implement the model. So they're getting books and puppets and visuals, and we're making visuals for them. And then they're getting this very intensive structured coaching, which the main piece that I would say is important to this discussion is they're getting ongoing performance feedback. So they're getting feedback based on goals they and their coach have decided together, based on observations and based on data of their own implementation of the practices, using that to give them feedback. Well, when we do that, we get pretty good changes in teacher behavior. And so if you look, so what this represents is our teachers from last year. So this represents 10 intervention teachers and 8 control teachers. The blue is control, the red is experimental. And what you can see from these data are the control teachers actually looked a little bit better, although not significantly, at time one. But over time, they actually got a little worse. But again, not significantly. But what I think's interesting about these data, if you go back to our study on the reliability of the measure, you saw that stability over time in the without intervention, and you see that here in the control teachers. But the experimental teachers actually almost all got pretty close to criterion. Now, one of the issues that I think about these data as I was looking at these data are wave one happens, you know, like in October. Between wave one and wave two, the teachers get trained on the model, and they might get a coaching session or two, but they haven't gotten a lot of individualized support here. That really kind of picks up between wave two and wave three. What a question that we have and that we're concerned about is this issue of dosage and exposure to the intervention and whether kids get enough exposure for enough time to really expect that there would be change. So if you think about wave three would be January, beginning of February, and then wave four would be end of March, beginning of April. And so that's where we're seeing the most change in teacher behavior. And so the question is that going to be long enough to see effects on kids? We just don't know that yet. No, they weren't significantly. It wasn't significant at wave one. Of course, they were at wave four. That's where but they weren't at wave one. And there's no way. I mean, their data, these are the class data, the control teachers looked better on the class at wave one, too, than the experimental teachers. So I was looking at this table yesterday thinking, why am I showing this table? Because there's no effects. I mean, that's the big message from this. So the experimental teachers on emotional support and classroom organization got a little better, but none of those differences were significant. There weren't significant differences between groups. But this is important. This is an important finding to me because those of you guys who are in early childhood know that this is the tool that people are using these days to measure quality in early childhood classrooms. And what's been really interesting, there's two things that I think are kind of notable about these data. One are that When we presented these data at the IES Project Directors meeting this summer, we had like two or three other research groups come up and say, we didn't get any change on the class either. And so if you think about the way the class is scored, about the way the scores are averaged and then averaged again, you maybe understand how hard it would be to get changes. But what's also the case is in these first two dimensions, the scores are pretty high to begin with. So if you think about a scale of 1 to 7 and scores, the average score is somewhere around a 5, those are pretty decent scores to begin with. So I think that's interesting. But the other interesting thing is about this instructional support domain, which is incredibly low. But if any of you have ever been to class training, what the trainers will tell you is you'll almost never have a preschool classroom that gets a score higher than 3. And so one would ask, why do you have it on a preschool measure, right? But they talk about how some of the strategies that are under instructional support require cognitive abilities of kids that 3- and 4-year-old children just don't have. And so even when Pianta, the guy who developed the scale, gets changes, he doesn't get changes on this domain. He doesn't get changes on any of the domains. He's more likely to see changes on items within the domain. So I think this is interesting. I think this is what people are consistently finding who are using the class. It probably wasn't a great measure to show change in our teachers over time. All right, I want to just talk a few minutes quickly here about what our kind of next steps are, what I see as the big issues. Obviously, our big question is, what are the effects of this model on children? And hopefully we'll know that this summer. I, of course, am concerned, as many of the people who do research in this area are, about the extent to which we really have good measures of child outcomes. So we chose to do two things: observational measures, teacher report measures. You know, it's not like math or literacy where you can probe a child and test them to see if they know it. You can't probe them about behavior. You either have to observe it or have to get somebody to report it. And there's problems with both of those, especially in the context of our study. Problem with observation is, how much do you have to do to get a good picture, and can you afford to do that much observation? And I'm not sure about that. The issue with teacher report measures, particularly as it relates to our study, is if you get changes in scores on the SSIS, so a teacher report measure, does that really represent changes in child behavior, or does it represent changes in teacher perception of child behavior? And I think that's a big deal in our study because we're training teachers, okay? So we got that confound that we're training teachers and then we're asking them to be informants about changes in child behavior as a result of training them. But the other thing is that we spend a lot of time in our training talking to teachers about reframing how they view problem behavior. And so not thinking about problem behavior as the child doing something to you or being bad, but thinking about problem behavior as communicating a message, and that we just have to understand what the function of the behavior is, and that helps us know how we need to respond. So maybe we just change the way we have teachers say, you know, it just doesn't seem as challenging to me anymore. I don't think it's because the behavior's changed. I think maybe their perception's changed. So I'm a little concerned about what that really tells us. Some might argue changing teacher perception is a good outcome too, however. The last big issue that we're interested in is looking at different approaches to training. Our model, where you do three full days of intensive training, give teachers a lot of materials, do intensive coaching, so teachers get somewhere on average about 11 or 12 coaching sessions. They get about 11 or 12 email feedbacks. Half the time our coaches are making materials for them. I don't think that's a model of professional development that many school systems are going to adopt. I mean, it's expensive, it's costly, it's time intensive. And so one of the things we've been thinking about are there ways to combine approaches to feedback that will be less time intensive? And so I think we're going to know some of that from Kathleen's study. Our kind of initial thoughts based on the work we've done so far is that you can use email feedback for really specific behaviors, but we're not sure if email feedback will give teachers the level of support they need around more general class, how you manage your classroom kinds of behaviors. And then the last thing is that we run into is we go out to talk to teachers about this model, and they say things like, well, but I'm already doing a literacy curriculum, or I'm doing a math curriculum. And so one of our challenges is how to help teachers see that this isn't a curriculum, to think about this as just how you, I mean, the bottom levels of the pyramid, if they're in place, make instruction, whether it's literacy or math or anything else, easier to implement. You know, you got to have a process for supporting kids whose behavior is persistent, regardless of what other curriculum you're implementing. And so I think a challenge for us is how to think about and talk about this with teachers in a way that makes them feel like this isn't just one more thing they have to do. We have 5 minutes left. Does questions, comments, thoughts? Paul.
Wonderful presentation.
Oh, thank you.
I really enjoyed the process that you led us through in terms of how you're measuring what you're doing, and talking about the measurement issues that you have here just seems spot on to me. So really, I just wanted to say thank you. You're doing a great job.
Thank you, Paul. You know, one of the things that people will suggest, and Paul, you might know more about this than I do, is this issue of measuring, of using executive function measures. And, you know, people always say, why aren't y'all doing executive function measures? And my response to that is we don't yet know if children who demonstrate change on these executive function measures, we don't know if that has any effect on their behavior in classrooms. And what we're interested in, and what our focus is on, is can we change the level of problem behavior in preschool classrooms? And I just don't know of any better way to measure it than we're doing, and yet I'm not sure our measurement system's going to be adequate. Yeah.
If you have any plans to go back and look at the classrooms in the years after you've trained the teachers, because I wonder if it's enthusiasm, or because people are doing things for, you know, making materials for them, or also if they're able to, if they get feedback on a, you know, through video on a specific behavior on a specific kid, if they can take that to, you know, the kid next year in their classroom.
We don't have plans to do that in this study. I think one of the things we're going to think about in our next project is whether we should be training teachers 1 year and then actually doing the trial the following year, and that'll become really important then. Anecdotally, when these guys have been out in some of the classrooms from our teachers from last year, they see the teachers doing some of the things, and actually they've come back with, you won't believe what this teacher was doing. But we're not measuring that in any systematic way. But I agree with you. I think that's really important.
Well, I think this is brilliant, of course.
Oh.
But I might be biased. You know, I think what you said about school districts aren't willing to do the intensity of intervention that it takes to make these kind of changes is a really important topic to talk about. And, you know, I don't know if your IAS Goal 2 has cost-benefit measures, but I think this is such an important issue. Because, in fact, you're talking about changing a lot of complex adult behavior. And everything we know about changing adult behavior from just about any kind of educational or psychotherapeutic study is that it doesn't happen quickly, and it doesn't maintain over time without some kind of support system. And so I just want to encourage you to collect that data and really analyze it carefully in both of those studies, because I think it's easy to say that we should press on to making things more cost-effective and less time-consuming without really having done the analysis of, first of all, how skilled are your trainers? I know your trainers, they're really skilled people delivering this intervention. And then what are the real costs and benefits of both of those kinds of models in terms of both teacher outcome and kid outcome? And that has such important policy implications, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I'm involved in a big national trial of multiple social-emotional curriculum, and we're trying to do this coaching model, but it's very dispersed, right? And so your point about are coaches well-trained is a huge issue. I mean, I think not only does it take a lot of coaching, it takes really skilled coaches to do what we're talking about, and that means the costs are even greater. But we don't have any evidence that you get changes in teacher behavior without some pretty intensive coaching. And so, you know, I'm making the assumption that school districts won't do that. I think what we have to think about is how can school districts do that in an efficient way. And so I think having people who run out to respond to a problem behavior is not the answer, but how do we make sure that the people who can support teachers on a daily basis are skilled at supporting them around this? And that's administrators and curriculum people and behavior support people. And so I think there's a way to do it that's not as costly, but I'm not convinced that there's a way to do it that's not as intensive. So, Elizabeth.
I just had a quick question about the coaching. What happens in coaching? Is it modeling? Is it try this, do it this way? I'm reminded of the therapist in training who has the bug in the ear and the supervisor is behind the one-way mirror telling them what to say, and don't ever say that. So what is involved in the coaching?
Yes, so coaching, everybody thinks of coaching in a different way. So during the observation, so when the coach is there observing the teacher, a number of things could happen. They could just sit and observe. They might say, I'm going to go try some things with Andrew. Watch and let's see what happens. They might say, this would be a really good time to prompt the kids to try to solve the problem themselves. But then the coaching session where the teacher and the coach meet together is more likely to be a discussion about what happened, how it worked, maybe looking at video clips. Both of those, we have very structured protocol for what the components of those are. But it could be any of the things that you talked about. Doug.
I enjoyed the presentation, too.
Oh, thank you.
I would encourage you to, when you get a chance, to look at your fidelity measure as my colleagues and I are doing with our sets of fidelity measures, and once you have outcome data, to look at relationships between the items on your fidelity measure and your student outcome data, because even though we're all good at coming up with logical, oftentimes theoretically based fidelity measures, they don't necessarily, all of those items don't necessarily need to be there. And there's some indication on the basis of others' work that, you know, 100 plus fidelity measures like I have can be reduced to relatively few items that capture most of the variance in desired student outcomes. Mm-hmm. So it's a way of looking for efficiency. It's also a way of rethinking what your active ingredient may be in the intervention.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Doug. And I think we in our training have started emphasizing some things over other things because we think that that's what's really making more of a difference. But we can't really know that, I guess, until we have the data. But one of the things about this model is that we do this 3-day training and then teachers are kind of like, oh gosh, where do I start? And so I think that notion that we might be able to downsize what are the active ingredients is an important one from a training perspective as well. No questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.